Netflix, when they first created their advertising campaign, they were promoting a CPM of $65. That is higher than the 2022 Super Bowl. And the reason why is because they can personalize. They know that if you're, of this certain demographic, you're going to like Breaking Bad.
Welcome to another episode of Experiment Nation's podcast. Today we have the amazing David Manheim with us. He's written an incredible book called The Personalization Paradox, talking about how companies are trying to get a bit more personalized when it comes to talking to their customers. If you grew up with Disney and it's been a huge part of your childhood, you're going to love this book. And there's so much love and care. And David just is doing an incredible job just making personalization a bit more personal. David, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much. That was a really good intro. Really good.
Thank you, David.
I don't know what else to add. I mean, it's funny, isn't it? When people come on podcasts or what have you, they tend to talk about their credibility or their acknowledgements or something to demonstrate some kind of authority. But really, if we talk about personalization, we should be personal. So yeah, so I'll admit, I get anxious quite a lot. I've had panic attacks in my past. I prefer to have few friends rather than lots of friends. And I'm a big kid. I love Disney. Those are probably the things that define me the most anyways.
Yeah. Speaking of Disney, talking about your book, you talk about sort of this epiphany you had kind of waiting in line at Disney. Could you talk a little bit more about that? Because I'm sure waiting in line at Disney caused a lot of self-reflection.
I mean, when do you not wait in line? So I've been going to Disney. I mean, I'm a sicker fan, right? So I've been going 35 times. I'm 36 years old. And it's one year. You can probably guess what year that is, which sucks. But hey, first world problems. And being so brand loyal to this brand that I absolutely adore. I remember waiting in this line. They have a ride at the Magic Kingdom called Monsters Inc. Laugh Floor, and it's supposed to make you laugh. And there's a 2-hour queue for what is essentially like a 60, well, it was a bit longer, like a 90-second show. And I thought to myself, what am I doing here? It's almost this epiphany of, I've been coming here 35 years. I still have to stand in queue for 2 hours. And I feel like I'm about to buy a $70 piece of merchandise and get overcharged for a $4 soda. I felt at that moment in time like just a number and not a person. It's almost as though my brand loyalty to Disney felt nothing. And if you know anything about what's happened with Disney and theme parks recently, it feels as though they're extracting value. They're not adding it. They're nickel and diming the guest, really. And that's what they call us. They call us guests. And I didn't feel like a guest. I felt like a number. And so I came back to England penniless after that trip and decided to just ask a few people, like, how do brands make you feel? Is personalization, is being personable a thing anymore? Because in my experience, especially at Disney, unfortunately, it wasn't. That doesn't mean to say I won't go to Disney. I'm going in a few months. But like I say, sycophant, so...
It's incredible. And so talk about the journey. So you've got this epiphany waiting at Disney, and then so does the idea of a book come right away? Because I imagine, like, working in CRO, like how what was that process of someone doing CRO to produce a book about personalization?
Well, I think it's grown over time. That was probably the catalyst. Yeah. More than an epiphany. I mean, in CRO, I don't know how fellow CROers think, but I feel as though there's this whole debate of, conversion rate optimization, the title, we're optimizing our conversion rate. And it feels quite generic and aggregated. Okay. This conversion rate figure feels retrospective. It feels binary, yes or no, did they convert? It feels incredibly average, which I'm sure all your listeners already know. Yet we still talk about that figure infinitely. We still talk about the solutions to address that figure in equally generic terms, PDP, PLP, the location of the solution rather than the solution itself. And it feels backwards. It feels generic. It feels as though the solution to all this is personalization. But then what is personalization? Do people understand it? Is there a difference between segmentation and personalization? Why are we still abiding by this conversion rate figure and optimizing for the mass rather than focusing on the few? More focus creates more impact. And it's this that I just found really fascinating. And flip to that, the paradox of which is everybody says they want to do it. There's this perpetual hype. Every year is the year of personalization. but no year is. It's never been realized in the past 20 years of personalization becoming a thing. So what's preventing that, you know? So this all led me on a journey of asking a bunch of fabulous minds in the industry of what the hell is going on with personalization.
Brilliant. And in terms of like the different people, like, I mean, you've got some really interesting people you've interviewed in there. Could you maybe talk about sort of, you know, like who was like, which was the interview that really gave you an insight that you didn't have before?
I don't know. But what I do know is that, so there were 153 in total. And it almost felt like it never ended. Like I was doing it well at, you know, 18 months in advance. My first interview was Pep Lyon. I think I was his first customer for CXL Institute. He called me out on a LinkedIn post ages ago. So I thought it was only fitting for him to be my first interviewee. So there was that. But in terms of where the, like what was the one creative thing? I don't know, lots of people had very different opinions, which I found fascinating. But because of that, I didn't really reach a bell curve until about 100 people in. I found that fascinating. So I generally just asked a couple of questions, which is, what is your relationship like with personalization and who does it well? And then dovetailed from there. And it wasn't until about 100 or so interviews in that I started to get some real, like very, very similar answers and themes where it became not repetitive, but quite generalized. You know, I could easily bucket people.
Yeah,
and that's a lot, right? That's a lot of interviews. Usually, you know, a sample size of 10 or 20 or maybe 30 to 50 might get you that bell curve. But it took me a good 100. It might be me, my lack of interpretation and stupidity, but I sense it's just the topic is so complex. And that hindered me, if anything, because structuring a book, you know, writing 80,000 words on such a complex topic is like writing a couple of paragraphs on creativity. It almost doesn't do it justice. It's such a complex concept. It's an ethereal thing. How do you put that into words and structure your thoughts around that? I found that really difficult.
As a reader, the idea that you find it difficult to put into words just did not come across. It's a fun read. It's a good read. I think that's the other element as well. That's why I want to wonder, like you know, when it came to, we always think about like read, you know, we think of sometimes of like personas and customers. So in terms of you writing it, like, was there any personalization in terms of like, did you have a end reader in mind and user in mind when it came to your book? Like what was the process of you personalizing your content?
You know what? Ironically, it was the opposite. I felt like it was almost a mass audience, which is really ironic I was saying that. But what I wanted to do was, it just like coming on this podcast and saying, it feels silly for me not to be personal when talking about personalization. I felt the same within the book. You know, I'm a big kid. I'm quite satirical and pithy. I love comedians like Bo Burnham and Tim Minchin. I love writings and thoughts of, say, Scott Galloway, who are slightly more pessimistic or cynical about the world. And that's me. And it felt irresponsible for me to not be personal within this book. So I talk about Disney a lot. I talk about stories and knights and dragons. And it sounds really stupid talking about it out loud, I know. But it felt like it had to be an extension of myself. I don't know how you feel, but, you know, reading all these books here, a lot of them are very dry, very practical marketing books. And it's just not the type of person that I am. So it feels incongruent for me to write something like that. I'd much rather write something that is evidently filled with dragons.
Well, that's great. You know,
This is Romo Santiago from Experiment Nation. Every week, we share interviews with and conference sessions by our favorite conversion rate optimizers from around the world. So if you like this video, smash that like button and consider subscribing. It helps us a bunch. Now back to the episode.
Speaking of dragons, in your book, you have a section where you talk about sort of these three dragons. Could you tell the audience about that?
Yeah, they have different names. I took some out because I didn't want to be liable for anything. So these three dragons are the dragons that stand in our way of success, basically what I call the personalization paradise. And the dragons are the golden dragon, this is the big commercial. This is Smaug from Lord of the Rings, you know, the big commercial dragon that says, I want my money and I want it now and immediately. I demand a return on investment. And I think it's the commercial dragon that really prevents us from thinking about personalization the way that it should be. You know, these intangible feelings of relationship and trust. How do you put a value on me saying, oh, I really like your hair. You know, you've got a really, you have a really good hairline. You know, that those are really nice feelings rather than me trying to immediately sell you something and shove a product down your throat. So the commercial dragon is the biggest of all. And then there is the technological and data dragon. These are the most commonly cited reasons why personalization is prevented from reaching its paradise. It's where an over-reliance on technology or an assumption that technology will get us there, this narrative that AI will be the Lord and Savior to us all, or the data side of the very same dragon, which is one where I need all the data and a single view of the customer in order to even start personalization. Mm-hmm. And again, an over-reliance on that data, or using data as an excuse to not personalize, because let's be honest, the collection, the management, the integration, the accessibility of it all, and the regulation, not to mention, is a minefield. And third and finally, the third dragon, who I think is not necessarily the biggest dragon, but certainly the one that is the toughest to defeat, is what I call the deepfake dragon. It's one where you don't know whether it's quite human or not. And this is where it's really, very ironically, a site that we need to put the person back into personalization, yet it's also the person in personalization that prevents us from reaching the personalization paradise. There's a lot of alliterations in this book. And what I mean by that is that we need to be more human in how we personalize, mentioning hairlines or whatever it might be. But it is also the individual that is personalizing to other people that prevents us from achieving success. It is a combination of ego and greed, a lack of cohesion, silos within either physical silos or mental silos. It's this discussion of the value doesn't quite match the effort. And it's a fascinating world to explore. That came up a lot within a lot of my interviews. Ironically, the concepts of ego and greed, cynicism. I cite, I think Mark Pybus at Creative CX said that people can have like an element of PTSD after they've implemented personalization because it doesn't quite live up to their expectations. And the difference to, you know, the definition of happiness is just the difference of what was my expectation now to what reality actually is. You know, if it's above that expectation, then I'm happy. If it's below that expectation, then I'm unhappy. So the trick is to remove expectations or make them more realistic. And unfortunately, you know, vendors, agencies, they don't do a very good job at that because they are quite self-serving. I know I am one. In when they sell their product to the market, you know, get a 500% uplift here. Well, it's like buying a new car. You know, you always know that you see images of middle-aged white men driving in the hills on a sunny afternoon listening to Ed Sheeran. But after a week, that new car smell is gone and the kids are kicking the back seat of your car and screaming at you. Reality sets in. So yeah, so the three dragons are basically the golden dragon, the overly commercial one, the technology and data dragon, the two often most cited reasons, and the deepfake dragon, where really it's the human that prevents us reaching that paradise.
Yeah. You know, I think what you're talking about is so important. The fact that it's also that element of being of that PTSD, of the fact that personalization, you know, we talk so much about personalization, and you go into a place and you work on it, and then maybe it doesn't meet reality.
Yeah.
And then you say, well, what's the next stage? What's the next step? And yeah. So maybe what I'd like to do is maybe have a bit of clarification for the audience. So are you making the point that personalization is a dead end, or personalization needs to be done differently?
Oh no, absolutely, it needs to be done differently. There's no. The whole premise of my book is that I absolutely see a way out of all of this, but unfortunately, in an overly commercial world that is driven by data and being run more and more by computers, I feel like it's going to take some big catalyst to get us out of that. And there are three things that give me hope. The first of which is the pandemic was cited as a catalyst. You know, it helped QR codes, for goodness sake. It can help us. The second of which is data regulation. You know, the more and more that comes into force, I think that's a good thing. You're putting more control back into the customers, into our hands, and away from the retailers. It's less about, if I'm a retailer, it's less about how I can get data from you, and more how I can work with you with your information. And I think that's a beautiful, beautiful relationship when it comes to personalization. And the second of which is AI. And one of the most common cited reasons that I mentioned is that the effort doesn't quite match the value. You know, think about the mental effort required. This was cited quite a lot as well, where I'd much rather focus on 100% of my traffic than 10% of my traffic. It's easy to get a 1% uplift on 100% of my traffic than an equivalent 10% uplift on my 10% of traffic, okay, to get the same level of value. AI is definitely making that easier. There's no question about that. And I think that will accelerate more and more people, more retailers and more brands into this field of personalization. And I think they'll get more success from it. It's just ironically, I feel that it's a rather introspective question. By becoming more impersonal between human and computer, are we removing personalization? It's almost like the personal is becoming more impersonal. We're almost segregating ourselves as humans. So I find that fascinating. But yeah, it's definitely not a dead end. There's no question. I actually see the opposite. I see more hope. Just for reference, one of the reasons why I see more hope is ironically, it's money. You know, we know full well that more targeted advertising works better than the alternative. And the money is in the advertising. You look at the streamers, you know, of Netflix and Disney, how they're now promoting ads. And, you know, Netflix, when they first created their advertising campaign, they were promoting a CPM of $65. That is higher than the 2022 Super Bowl. And the reason why is because they can personalize. They know that if you're, you know, of this certain demographic, you're going to like Breaking Bad. But not just that, you're going to relate to Walter White because your psychographics suggest that you're more lonely and you feel at loss with the world. And not only that, but it's at an episodic level. So I won't give away spoilers, but you know, you might like Flies for those who know the Fly episode or whatever it might be. So yeah, I see a lot of hope for the future of personalization. I just think there needs to be a reframing and not forgetting the first three syllables of personalization being personal.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think kind of what I loved about Dave is you also kind of sketching out kind of like where we are and kind of where we're headed, but more importantly, where we should be heading to. Yeah. I think that's like a huge part of this. One thing I want to check with you is that you also talked about this kind of, a lot of times, you know, we conflate personalization with segmentation.
Yeah.
So could you maybe share a little bit more sort of like, you know, in some sense, how are these two things distinct and why are people kind of confusing them with each other?
Yeah, so it's a really good question. So there is this scale, right, of one to all and one to one over here. And in between, you've got one to many and one to few. And I think the one to few is segmentation. The one to all is just advertising. The one to many is optimization. The one to few is segmentation. And the one to one is usually classified as some kind of personalization, although I personally wouldn't classify it as that. The difference between segmentation and personalization, I think there's quite a few. So first of all, it's worthy of noting that there is a difference. And the reason why there's a difference is there's been a few empirical research studies that have been done on this that basically cite the difference between the two is the lack of contextualized data. So a segment is somebody or a group or cluster of people that you don't hold a lot of context about and within their in-moment thoughts. So an example that I think ThoughtWorks, the consultancy, gave was if I'm looking at buying microwaves, you might provide me a microwave dish. That is a form of segmentation because you know that I'm in the microwave category. But it lacks any context about why I might want, do I need that microwave dish? You don't understand the customer's intent. And I think that's one of the core differences. I think the second biggest difference is I don't see them as similar. I see personalization as more of a communication principle than a marketing one, if that makes sense. If you bear with me, what I mean by that is that experimentation, optimization, segmentation are all ways of doing things. They're almost like disciplines. Feel free to come at me with your pitchforks, but I'll die on this hill. And I see personalization as slightly more ethereal than that, slightly more conceptual. It's more of a communication principle. I'm being more personable with you. It doesn't matter whether I do that at a segmented level or an optimized level or an individual level or a mass level. I'm trying to acknowledge you and be familiar with you and help you and care for you and create a relationship with you, one that's based on mutual trust. For me, that's personalization. It's all about creating a relationship built on mutual trust. And for me, that's why it's more of a communication principle than a marketing discipline.
Fascinating. And I think what I love to be tied into is that in your book, you talk about sort of the care competency index. And I think so. Could you maybe share that concept with the podcast as well? I think it ties perfectly into what you were just talking about.
Yeah. So I must admit, it's not my concept. There's a book somewhere here called two researchers, Malone and Fisk, and they wrote something called The Human Brand, a book called The Human Brand. And they try to identify, as humans, what makes us trust one another. And they try to relate that to brands. So between a human and a brand relationship, what are the prerequisites of trust? And they identified an axis of two, care and competency. Can you help and will you help? And they go into all sorts of reasons why the fact that care is actually one of the biggest prerequisites in trust, that accounts for 60% of all of how we as humans trust each other. So for example, if you saw a person in a dark alley, Harry Potter style, walking down the street at you, and you're thinking, okay, can this person hurt me and will this person hurt me? That's obviously the other end of it. And the two are not mutually exclusive. So for example, when you at Christmas, you get your nan gets you a Christmas sweater with a cat on it, and it's bloody ugly, and you know for well it's going to get re-gifted. That's a factor of care, but not competency. She wants to help, but she just can't help. She's just inadequate at buying such gifts. And it's my hypothesis that as brands, we over-index in competency. Can you help? There we go. And under-index in care. Will you help? And the reasons why are simply that competency is easier to replicate, to simulate, and it has a return value against it. That's why you see Amazon do so well, is that, boy, are they competent. Great customer service, breadth of product, great recommendations, yada, yada, yada. They try to help, but God, they just won't help. They don't demonstrate a level of care, or what Malone and Fisk call is warmth, that personal feeling of like a branded experience. It is a reason why, when as optimizers, we all sit in boardrooms, and you know full well, usually the oldest person in the boardroom will say, what's it like in-store though? You know, how do we replicate the in-store experience? And there's a reason why you can't replicate it, or you want to replicate it. It's because it lacks care. The difference between online and offline is the absence of care, or the difficulty of simulating care. So that's, it's a concept by Malone and Fisk, but it's something that I feel is so closely tied towards personalization and being personable with one another, because it is a factor, a prerequisite of trust, which is a prerequisite of having a relationship with one another, which is a prerequisite of, hey-ho, lifetime value and customer centricity.
Yeah. Speaking of care and trust, do you have any I always think of like tips of low hanging fruit, like, and I know it may go against the spirit of what you're saying about being personal, but maybe that little ground, meaning if someone wanted to get a bit more personal and put the person in the center, what are the quick things that they could start doing to show that they care?
Well, I think there's the biggest blocker, and I'm going to give an example. So I think the biggest blocker is the need for an immediate, tangible return on your investment. It's almost impossible to demonstrate a level of care without increased effort. Usually that means more resource, and usually that means more cost. So if I want to demonstrate care, how can I prove the value of that back to my boss or a line item in a spreadsheet? It's nigh on impossible. And that is one of the biggest blockers, I feel, that we can't or don't simulate care. But an example of a company that I think did it really well as a single example is Bloom & Wild, the flower retailer in the UK, where they created what they call the thoughtful marketing movement, which is on Mother's Day, they allowed their users to opt out of communication from Mother's Day advertising, both on-site and in email, in the hope or the vein or the expectation that it's quite triggering to some people to receive a Mother's Day email when unfortunately you may not have a mother or you've lost a loved one. And rather than have the approach of a mass acquisition of all, and we'll get a reduced click-through rate, how about the alternative of understanding your audience's mindset, their context, their situation, their intent, and having a thought process of focus is more, or focus, not more isn't more. Acquisition is not sexier than retention, despite what we're told. More focus equals more impact. And that's exactly what Bloom & Wild did. And I think it's something that we should all learn from. I think that's a marker of care over competency.
And I think that ties into something that you previously said, is the idea that, on one hand, do you choose the sort of the spectrum is between being personalized to everybody and being personalized to a very few. And then finding that spot within that spectrum.
Yeah.
To kind of choose what you want to focus on.
Yeah, absolutely. I would try and reframe the conversation of personalization. For me, is not a marketing discipline. It's not an additional tactical add-on person or team or recommendations engine that you just plonk on your website. It is a communication principle. Those companies that will succeed in personalization are one where there's a genuine purpose behind it, an authentic reason as to why you're personalizing. And the answer for reference is not because it'll get us more money. It is because it'll get us closer to our customers, or our customers need more relevancy in their life or more resonation with what we're selling to them. So that's the way I would think about it.
Yeah. And then tying that back to that image of the golden dragon, I think that's why I love that image. One of the nice things about the book is not just it's the love, it's the care, it's the puns, it's the alliterations, mm-hmm. but it's also the vivid imagery, and seeing that golden dragon, you see gold and you understand with smog, but the gold, and the idea is that focus on immediate ROI, immediate focus on revenue, or even just revenue, versus understanding the customers is actually what could be the biggest blocker over here.
Yeah. And who knows whether I'm living in cuckoo land. To be fair, I acknowledge that. I give you examples of how Marks and Spencer, for example, when they were starting their personalization program, they went to their board, their FD, to say, okay, here's the return on investment. It's a 70 to 1 ROI or whatever it was. And they did all the research and everything. They benchmarked against other academic studies and case studies, which we know, let's be honest, are largely self-serving. And they found that the board kind of laughed them out of the room, and not to that much of an extent. And they told them to go away. It was unrealistic. I didn't believe your expectation. So instead of the next time when they went back to the board, instead of focusing just on the one figure of revenue, they focused on this balance of metrics. They have what's called like their bullseye platform, for example, which Alex Williams has shown me and talked about in great detail. And they use the Adobe suite. And that balance of metrics that isn't just solely focused on revenue is what got them over the hump of being able to successfully implement a personalization platform that has done really well for them. It allowed them to purchase thread.com, for example, and their recommendation algorithm which they call Thimble. So they've done really well. But there are examples in that where you need a balance of metrics, not just a myopic focus on a single metric. It's a balance.
Yeah. Yeah, and speaking of balance, I mean, here you are, you're working in CRO, you've just written a book, but you also got a software coming out that deals with personalization. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so it's called Made with Intent. I think in writing, the book and the business are very different from one another. And the two are mutually exclusive. But one of the things that I've been laboring on for quite some time is this concept of intent. I'm a big football fan. And there's a concept known as expected goals. And what expected goals was introduced back in 2012. And what it's designed to do is to help you understand in a football match the quality of the chances that are created, not the quantity, but the quality. And they use all sorts of regression analysis to understand the possession of play, the angle of the shot, the distance of the shot, and they mark it as a score out of 1 and 10. So it's a predictor metric, not a retrospective one. And they did that to combat the aggregation that a football match had, i.e. it's 1-0 to Chelsea, it's 5-0 to Manchester United, I hope. And that isn't a marker of quality. It's a marker of results, not necessarily performance. United could have overperformed. Chelsea could have overperformed. And so I think we can bring that notion to the world of e-commerce. So in fact, we have done by understanding expected conversion, not actual conversion, by understanding the quality of your traffic and composition of your traffic, by understanding customer intent, we can then personalize effectively. We can understand the quality of our traffic, not just the quantity of the results. So our software comes out, I think mid-June will be the first MVP to 10 beta clients, and we allow retailers to understand the intent of their visitors. It's cool.
Yeah, it sounds like it. But, you know, I mean, just excited by that. Davidson, thank you so much for being on our episode today. If there's anybody who wants to find out more about you, find out about your book or your software, where could they find out more about you?
Oh, just LinkedIn, probably. I'm always ranting or raving about something. And my book comes out late July. There is like a newsletter that you can sign up to. There's over 1,000 people on there, which is really humbling and equally anxiety inducing. It's going to be a bumpy ride.
Yeah. Well, I wish you nothing but the best. Thank you so much for joining us today, David.
Thank you. Appreciate it.